as usual, correct, Desi Doyen.
Tune in to the Bradcast every Monday at 3 p.m. right here on KPFK.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and streaming across the globe at kpfk.org. Radio powered by the people.
A few comments about the organizing. The organizing is being carried out by FIFA. A few comments about FIFA. FIFA was founded in 1904, basically by British and French sporting people affiliated with football at the time. FIFA, being born at that time, was part of a spate of international sporting federations.
Memories are forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, all down the...
Good morning and welcome to another working week. This is KPFK's Working Voices. I'm your host, Joe Ayala, president of NABIT CWA Local 53.
And I'm your co-host, Marissa Remsky of CWA Local 9003.
And in this morning's show, Steve Zelser brings us an interview with Professor George Wright about the ramifications of FIFA and the World Cup. Reggie Wong takes us back to July 4th for a moment with activist Carrie Scoville and the labor history San Pedro's Liberty Hill. Kristen Parker has this week's Education Workers Report Card on school board elections. And our associate producer, Hal Lohr, has the June job numbers in our latest Working Voices update. All this and more coming up this morning on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. This is Working Voices.
In our first story this morning, from his labor video YouTube channel, Steve Zelser brings us Professor George Wright, who has spent his life giving a class analysis on the role of the Olympics, Super Bowl, and World Cup, as he talks about the history of the FIFA World Cup and how it has been corrupted to increase privatization and profiteering.
This is Steve Zelser with Workweek, and we're in the midst of the FIFA games taking place all over the country, and we're going to be talking with Professor George Wright. He has studied sports and the relationship of capitalism to sports for the working class and for the world economy and what's going on today in the spectacle that's taking place in the United States. Welcome to the show, George.
Pleasure to be with you. Yeah, what I'd like to talk about today is the politics around the current World Cup football competition that's happening in the United States, as well as in Canada and Mexico. In fact, this is the first time that the World Cup has been hosted jointly by three different countries. The most that happened before was in 2002, when both South Korea and Japan hosted the competition. But normally, it's only one country that hosts the World Cup. I think the first thing I want to say about this iteration of the World Cup, and this is the 23rd time that the World Cup has been conducted, starting with the first that was held in Uruguay in 1930. It is a perfect melding of capitalism, and to be more specific, late capitalism, meaning the extreme greed of capitalism in decline, as well as politics, and politics obviously within the context of Trumpism and all of the fascist, anti-immigrant corruption around Trump, as well as thirdly, sport itself and the reality that sport can be a capitalist, but there is also beauty within sport as well. And so what I'd like to do is to talk about those three components somewhat separately, but at the end, more or less tie them together. Before I do that, there are a couple things I want to talk about. One frame that I use in personally watching sport was laid out back in 1972 by a journalist by the name of Bill Gilbert, who wrote for the sports magazine Sports Illustrated. And he wrote an article, I think it was December 25th, 1972, entitled Troubles from a Gleaning Time. And what Gilbert was able to do in a very prescient way was to take note of the major economic changes that were on the horizon related to sport as it was moving into a deeper capitalist framework. And for that matter, an international framework as well. There was a categorization of the projection he saw related to sport that captured my imagination at the time. And that framework still holds true when I look at sport as well. At the essence of sport, the beginnings of sport really has to do with play and recreation. For example, when we talk about the World Cup and the hugeness economically and politically that it represents, and for that matter, culturally today, we have to remember that the sport really started in the middle of the 19th century in England, where workers working in mines needed some kind of recreation on weekends to just have fun. Meaning to play. And so we see the beginnings of football, or soccer as it's called in the United States, as basically recreation, where now almost 200 years later, that it is a highly internationalized corporatized enterprise, if you will. So at the essence of any sport is play. Now, what you have to do, though, is frame that concept into a set of concepts. And this next framework that Gilbert comes up with is something he called big sport. And this is something that he was beginning to see happen in sport. And that was the beginnings of money, big money into sport that was being facilitated by television. Okay. And there is no better example a big sport on an international level than the World Cup. I would also argue that today the Olympic Games would fit into that. On a domestic level here in the United States, the Super Bowl would probably be an example of big sport, etc. But also what he was able to glean in his article, that's a word that came from the title of his article, was something that is at the essence of why sport can be alluring and attractive to people, and that has to do with high sport. And high sport can be defined in terms of brilliance or excellence being expressed by an individual. Big sport can take place within play as well. I know on a personal level, I'm not the greatest basketball player in the world, but once I was able to make 5 shots in a row, that was my excellence, if you will, or that was my high sport. But when you look at today's World Cup, there's no question that high sport can transcend big sport when you see the activities of Lionel Messi from Argentina, Kylian Mbappe from France, Ronaldo from Portugal, Harry Kane from England as well. Things that these human beings can do that transcend the capitalism of sport. So I want to stress very strongly that this philosophical framework has helped me to enjoy sport within the context of an increasingly capitalist phenomenon. The next thing I want to say has to do with give a little introductory information about the World Cup itself. The World Cup, as I said before, this is the 23rd iteration of the World Cup. The first World Cup took place in 1930, as I said, in Uruguay. The World Cup is hosted every 4 years, except for the war years. The World Cup was in 38, and then the next World Cup, was in 1950. Ever since, every 4 years, there has been a World Cup. Currently, there are 48 teams or nations that are participating in this current competition at this point. A few comments about the organizing. The organizing is being carried out by FIFA, F-I-F-A, which basically means the International Federation of Football Associations, the International Federation of Football Associations. A few comments about FIFA. FIFA was founded in 1904, basically by British and French sporting people affiliated with football at the time. FIFA, being born at that time, was part of a spate of international sporting federations that were organized at the time. For example, the International Olympic Movement was founded in 1906. We see the other international federations being founded about that time at the same time. Swimming, FINA, F-I-N-A, was founded around that time. The International Amateur Athletic Federation, which is the International Track and Field Federation, now called World Athletics, was formed around 1910, for example. So what we begin to see is the international organization of different amateur sports at this early stage. And these international federations have jurisdiction over their respective sports, also jurisdiction over the regulation and the sanctioning of international competitions, as well as rules and regulations of the sport. Although with football, i.e. soccer, there is an international body that more specifically deals with rules and regulations, but FIFA is part of that body, for example. The next point I want to make about this story is that up until the late 1970s, early 1980s, the World Cup, and for that matter, FIFA, was basically a non-profit organization, meaning that they weren't committed to making profit in a dramatic way. How the operation worked is the International Federation gave to a bidding nation the right to conduct the competition, i.e. in this instance, the World Cup. And it was the organizers within that nation that funded the World Cup. And that those fundings generally came from the public sector, both local and state resources, national resources. Where there was profit was the local industries, the local businesses, hotels, restaurants, services for those hospitality institutions as well. But the FIFA itself was not committed to profit. This was true with every international federation, certainly the Track and Field Federation, and certainly the Olympic Movement operated exactly the same time. But there was a major shift that took place in the 1970s into the 1980s. And it was the International Olympic Organization, or Committee, that was at the forefront of these changes. Back in 1978, the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, was going to choose the host for the 1984 Olympics. But what happened is there was only one city that was bidding for the Olympics because the cost of funding was dramatically increasing because of inflation on a global level. That city was Los Angeles. So the IOC had to give the Olympics to Los Angeles, to the Olympic Organizing Committee. But the Olympic Organizing Committee said that they could not take any public money for the organizing of the 84 Olympic Games. How the games were to be funded was through private monies, okay? And so a guy named Peter Uberoff, who was the head of the Los Angeles Olympic Organizing Committee, came up with a framework for the organizing of the 1984 Olympics for funding. It consisted of the following. One is television revenue, meaning to sell television rights to television companies in the United States. It could be ABC, NBC, CBS. In this instance today, it's Fox is paid the yeoman's amount to broadcast the Olympics. Now, obviously, this is beneficial for the television company because they can sell commercial time. So they make a profit as well in all of this. More on the specifics of that in a minute. A second source of funding was through licensing logos, for example, to firms, meaning they could put the Olympic rings on T-shirts or on book jackets or on pens or whatever. So that was a source of funding. Also sponsorship, meaning to sell sponsorship to corporations. And the corporations would pay money to the organizing committee. If you're watching the World Cup today, what we see is that there's some 26 major sponsors to the World Cup. And you'll see the signage on the stadiums. The ones that stand out would be Bank of America, DoorDash, McDonald's, Aramco has paid money. There are three Chinese companies, Lenovo, for example, et cetera. Now, they have provided a significant amount of money to FIFA for these games, and they have the quote-unquote rights to have signage in these stadiums, et cetera. A final source of revenue would be ticketing, meaning to charge to earn revenue from selling tickets. We'll talk specifically about this particular Olympic Games as well.
90.7 KPFK, Los Angeles.
So we see the framework of private funding or private financing of the 1984 Olympics. Almost immediately, every major international sports federation began to adapt that model to their own functioning. And so starting in the latter part of the 1980s, FIFA began to operate with this privatization model. But by the way, there's one other area that I want to comment on. As the international sports was becoming privatized and corporatized, there was a parallel development within the ranks of athletes as well. Many of the participants in the Olympics prior to the 1980s were amateurs, meaning they were not professionals. They did not earn money from their sports activities. In the 1980s, the International Olympic Committee changed the rules of amateurism to where now athletes themselves could be professional. So that now we see most of the athletes in these competitions, if not all of them, are professional. And what I mean by that, they're under contract from shoe companies like Nike or Adidas. And if you notice in these competitions, their shoes are very prominent in the competition. They also get prize money in their competition, and also appearance fees. I'm going to give some specific figures in a minute related to this framework and how it applies to the current World Cup process. So the next area, what we'd like to talk about is how much money is FIFA earning in this World Cup competition that's going on concurrently? Just to kind of give a framework, how any international sporting federation categorizes their money is they define it in terms of cycles. For example, related to FIFA, the last World Cup was in Qatar back in 2022. So we are now in the current cycle that started in 2023 through 2026. So any money that FIFA earns is during that cycle contributes to the total amount of money earned by FIFA during that four-year cycle. What we can say clearly is that the previous cycle, 2019 to 2022, FIFA earned about $7 billion total during that four-year period through those different mechanisms, television revenue, ticketing, as well as sponsorship and licensing. This current cycle, FIFA expects to earn $14 billion, okay? And the World Cup itself will generate approximately $9 billion. So we're talking about almost a 35% increase in revenue from this particular competition. Part of what's also unique about this cycle of the World Cup is FIFA has mandated that it is in control of everything, every source of revenue FIFA has its fingers on. Sometimes it's the local organizing or national organizing committee that also can generate revenue. For example, FIFA controls revenue from ticketing. It controls revenue from transportation of spectators to stadiums, et cetera, et cetera. It does not control revenue from hotels, by the way, people staying in hotels or eating at restaurants. So out of that, some $9 billion, the actual figure is about $8.9 billion, but we rounded it off. What are the amounts that are being earned by FIFA from this World Cup? Related to media rights, they're earning $4.2 billion, or about 39% of the total revenue. From ticketing, they're earning a little over $3 billion, which is about 28% of earnings. Marketing, meaning licensing, they're earning about $2.7 billion. And from sponsorship, it's about an equal amount of money as well. They're generating wealth or profits from these different sectors. I have to take note of the ticketing situation and to some degree the transportation. What is extremely egregious about this particular World Cup is the pricing for ticketing. If you look at previous competitions, tickets were fairly reasonable for people who were truly fans of the sport. They might have to travel to the locale, but tickets were pretty reasonable. For example, in Russia in 2018, and where the final game was in Moscow, 2018, the highest price ticket for the final game in Moscow in 2018 was about $1,000, okay, which sounds like a lot of money, but there were tickets that were a lot cheaper than that. In Qatar in 2022, it was $1,100. It is estimated that for the final game in New York on July 19th, the average ticket will be about $16,000. And there are tickets that have been sold in the secondary market for $2 million. That's for one seat to watch a two-hour football competition, okay? That revenue, again, is going directly to FIFA in all of this. Now, one of the themes about the privatization and corporatization of sports is the notion of the Americanization of sport, meaning that these international federations in the last 40 years have adapted mechanisms that the United States sporting groups, even like Major League Football or Major League Baseball or football, have adopted to their international organizations. Two things that have been done by FIFA during this World Cup is, one, to adapt something called dynamic pricing, meaning to designate the price of a ticket based on demand, okay? Rather than to have a set price ahead of time, you know, you buy your tickets 2 months ahead of time, the final game, the list price, the face value of the ticket is $850, and you're going to pay $850 or $202 or whatever it is. The prices for these tickets are based on the demand. And so they're able to charge whatever they can get in the open market, okay? The second thing they've done, which is to me even more egregious than the dynamic ticketing process, I'm editorializing here, obviously, and that is that for over 100 years, football has been played in two halves that are 45 minutes each. And so there is a particular rhythm and flow to the match between the two competing teams. What FIFA has interjected into this competition is something called a hydration break, quote unquote, under the pretense that the competitions will be held in environments that are going to be very hot. Okay. And so this gives it a 3-minute opportunity for the players to get water or Gatorade or Powerade or whatever sponsor controls the liquid. But what this has also allowed is additional commercial time for Fox to make more revenue from the competition. Now, I haven't really read any assessments on how this affects the flow of the game and all of this, but I assure you, when this World Cup is over, there are going to be scores of articles evaluating the meaning of this. But what this does is it also sets precedent for other regional federations to begin doing the same thing so they can find additional sources of money. I do, to be fair to FIFA and for that matter the IOC or World Athletics, I do have to make note, though, is that the bulk of that money does go back into the sport. So what does FIFA use that money for? Obviously, the money goes into staging the tournaments. There's a World Cup, there's a pre-World Cup, and there's a Women's World Cup competition, etc. So FIFA does pump this money back into organizing these competitions. There is money sent to various nations around the world that is called development and educational monies, training for referees, for coaches, managers, youth football programs, etc. So there is money pumped back into the sport, money for the operation of FIFA, etc. And then for the specific competitions, there is also prize money to the winning teams, for example. For example, for this competition, for this World Cup, FIFA has designated $871 million for prize money and it's based on a scale of what place you are as a team in the competition. What is also important is that each nation participating in this competition, some 48 nations, each nation gets $12 million, regardless of their performance. And the winning nation gets some $53 million. Also, because almost all of the athletes are professional athletes, and they play for professional leagues in respective cities, or respective countries like Bayern Munich in Germany or Real Madrid in Spain or Arsenal in England or PSG in France, there's some $355 million that had been designated for those respective clubs to be able to compensate them for the use of their professional athletes within the World Cup. But what we must stress very strongly, anywhere between $10 and $15 billion of the 10 to 15% of that money is raked off on the top for the FIFA officials, et cetera. So everybody makes a nice pad of money throughout this process. And the potential for corruption is deeply embedded in this process. My only frustration is this great, great celebration of the in the United States through its media of the U.S. team and even chants during the stadium of USA, USA, USA. It does have some portent of Germany in 1936 to a little bit. But when the U.S. has to play in the quarterfinals, if they get through the next game, they will have their comeuppance, and Trump will not be giving the World Cup trophy to the U.S. team. Okay, I'll put money on that one.
That was Steve Zeltser from his Labor Video YouTube channel. For more videos and insights from Steve Zeltser, you can go to his Labor Video YouTube channel, or now you can find him at the production of Labor Video Project on the web at labormedia.net.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
Si porque te quiero, quieres, llorona, que yo.
Next up, every July 4th, the San Pedro Neighbors for Peace and Justice pay tribute to labor figures such as singer, activist Joe Hill, and the industrial workers of the world. This year, member Carrie Scoville spoke about the history of Liberty Hill, which is on 5th and Harbor Streets in San Pedro. Reggie Wong reports.
Hi, my name's Carrie, and yes, my parents were founding members of San Pedro Neighbors for Peace and Justice, along with you, when you were at First and Gaffey every Friday from 2003 to 2020. It ended because of COVID, but now it's back at 13th and Gaffey. Every Friday at 5 o'clock, the vigil is still on because war is still on. I'm going to give a little background on this place, on where we're at, why it's historical, and why we celebrate 4th of July here. What we have on this rock that the panel said are missing, this missing panel right here, was a California State Historic Landmark for Liberty Hill, because of the story I'm about to tell you. And on that side of the rock was an ILWU plaque for Liberty Hill. This was the Liberty Hill Monument. And this plaque here has Joe Hill. And I'm going to speak to these locations. I'm afraid I'm going to read to you. By the way, Rachel Brunke, who is not here today, she's traveling the country right now. She and I have done a number of car caravans, historic car caravans throughout San Pedro, going to local monuments and reclaiming them, World War II monuments, and reclaiming them as Antifa, because they're here from World War II and they're anti-fascists. So we want to reclaim the anti-fascist history of San Pedro, why it's here, why these were put here, why these were built here, why they are monuments today. So I'm going to read you a little bit from some of my landmark tours. Before the ILA, that's the International Longshore Association, the precursor to the ILWU, and before the mighty ILWU, There was the Industrial Workers of the World, or the Wobblies. They were active in San Pedro, especially from 1910 to 1924. Not that they're not active anymore, but that was the strong heyday, organizing workers into one big union, or a union of all trades, so everyone could join this union. Joe Hill resided here for a few years from 1910 to 1913. He stayed at 329 Beacon Street, which is now the Boys and Girls Club. And he would go to a soup kitchen next door, the Sailor's Rest Mission at 341 Beacon Street, right here, the Boys and Girls Club, every day, where he could play the piano. And he would also go to bars and places around San Peter where he could play the piano and sing songs, sing labor songs, sing worker songs. So he stayed at the soup kitchen for a few years. He finally, he was disappointed in what he saw in San Peter because the workers were so ground down to the ground, needing bare necessities, that they were not ripe enough to organize into a union, he felt. They were so downtrodden. So eventually he hopped a train and went to Parts North, but not before he wrote a number of songs here, like Pie in the Sky. There'll be pie in the sky when you die, was written right here in San Pedro. The conditions for workers were desperate. Being the least skilled workers, the dock workers were the most exploited. Joe Hill ate with them in the soup kitchen, suffering through sermons, because of course you had to hear a sermon in order to eat. He finally left San Pedro because he realized when workers are not getting their basic needs met, they cannot be organized. This was when the Port of LA was emerging and expanding as a location of industry and employment. The industries were fishing, rail, a ship's crew, dock workers, and then the shipbuilders. The first dredging and the breakwater were completed in 1912 when he was here. Pier A in Wilmington was built in 1914. The first shipyard, the Los Angeles Shipyard, which later became Todd Shipyard over there where Southwest Slip is, was built in 1917. So this is World War I. We also had a military base here during World War I. Fort MacArthur started here during World War I. Throughout these years, the IWW continued to organize and to conduct multiple strikes and job actions at the waterfront. One focus was the elimination of Fink Hall, or for a proper hiring hall. Fink Hall was what they called it. At the time, the bosses would come to an assembly of workers and they would pick out the strongest, the youngest, and the toughest ones and say, "You're going to crew with me today," and leave the rest behind. That was called Fig Hall. That's not a hiring hall. The Wobblies fought for a proper hiring hall. The Klan was active in the harbor area from 1918 up until the 1930s. They fought any attempt to organize labor in the area and would show up, hooded or not, to intimidate the dock workers, to prevent them from organizing. The police, the San Peter Chambers, and sailors also made up vigilantes who fought organizing efforts. The California Criminal Syndicalism Act of 1919 primarily was against the Wobblies, meant that any two people meeting under a Wobbly banner to organize could be arrested, and they were. In 1923, there was a major maritime strike here in Los Angeles and up and down the ports. Upton Sinclair, the author, he was at Liberty Hill here reading the Bill of Rights in support of the maritime strike in 1923. The strike was intended to lead to a nationwide general strike. Over 200 people were arrested here, and that they wound up in jail up on the top floor of City Hall is a jail. And that's where they caused such a commotion and sang and protested that they were called the singing jailbirds. And they were finally released because I couldn't stand them any longer. Oh, and here we are. Here we are. The singing jailbirds right there. And so that action, the reading of the Bill of Rights, got Upton Sinclair arrested along with the 200 others. That started an action that wound up becoming the ILWU. So what started by the Wobblies wound up forming the ILWU in later years. And we actually did have general strikes in the 30s. But it started here in Los Angeles, 1923. And that was the impetus for the founding of the Southern California chapter of the ACLU, that action right here. And also the namesake of the Liberty Hill Foundation. Maybe you're familiar with it. And we come here every 4th of July at 5th and Harbor to commemorate that action and remind us of labor and the Wobblies and the great contributions they made. Thank you.
The Joe Hill Monument is on 100 West 5th Street by Harbor Boulevard in Los Angeles. For more information on San Pedro Neighbors for Peace and Justice, check them out at Pedro for Peace. That's number 4 for 4 on Instagram. And that was Reggie Wong for Working Voices.
Everybody knows the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with the fingers crossed. Everybody knows that the war is over. Everybody knows that the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight is fixed. The poor stay poor and the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
You're listening to Working Voices on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Kristen Parker's Education Workers Report Card looks at school elections, and Moms for Liberty's candidate for California School Superintendent, Sonia Shaw, accusing Governor Newsom of power grab over California Department of Education overhaul.
This is Kristen Parker of the Montebello Teachers Association, and in this morning's report card, with elections just over 3 months away, California Department of Education superintendent candidate and extreme anti-LGBTQ parental rights conservative Sonia Shaw decided to accuse Governor Gavin Newsom last week on Fox News of making the biggest power grab in California's history after Newsom stripped oversight of the California Department of Education from the state superintendent to a new governor-appointed education commissioner. The education overhaul, pushed through by Newsom earlier this month, a move that brings California into alignment with most other U.S. states where the education superintendent is a political appointment of a sitting governor, removes authority from the long-standing state superintendent role. Sonia Shaw, obviously frustrated with the idea that a political office she had hoped to win and then used to push an ultra-conservative or MAGA agenda across California, said in the interview Saturday that Newsom used a backdoor deal for the change. She said, "I have not backed down from Newsom's cabal," and adding the threat that she intends to fight the overhaul in federal court. Shaw, president of the Chino Valley Unified School District Board, advanced to the November election along with Richard Barrera, president of the San Diego Unified School Board, as the top two vote-getters in the primary for California's superintendent of public instruction. Shaw has won support from a wave of ultra-conservative, Moms for Liberty-styled anti-LGBTQ parents' organizations across the state who are concerned about issues like transgender athletes in girls' sports and parental notification policies designed to force teachers to out students suspected of being gay. Shaw, who has never actually spent any time in a classroom working as a teacher, possesses no college degree, teaching certification, or school district's labor union membership. She rose to prominence after she accused current California Department of Education Superintendent Tony Thurmond of perverting children, and then drove him out of a Chino Valley Unified Board meeting over his lack of support for the persecution of LGBTQ students. Staff and student workers in the California State University system are threatening to strike when school begins this year. On Tuesday, the contract expired between the California State University Employees Union and the California State University. That contract covers 36,000 non-teaching staff throughout the CSU system. Sacramento State held a practice picket on Tuesday. During one picket, workers chanted, "What do we want? Fair contracts." Last month, CSU employees rallied at San Francisco State University during an active bargaining session. The state of California puts a premium on educating our next college graduates, CSU EU President Catherine Hutchinson said in a statement, supporting the essential frontline staff who help students succeed must be a priority for CSU leadership. So far, unions have not voted or set a date for a potential strike. The CSU respects the free speech right of our union members, Amy Bentley Smith, spokesperson for the university system. The CSU is currently in negotiations with CSU EU and is committed to bargaining in good faith toward achieving an agreement that recognizes and supports the work of our staff in fulfilling CSU's mission. At the same time, student assistants who unionized in 2024 and work for private service contractors on campus are also bargaining for their first contract. Princess Moss is the new president-elect of the National Education Association and will take the reins of one of the most influential K-12 organizations in the U.S. at a time of rapid change in the education landscape. Moss, 65, taught elementary music for 21 years in Louisa County, Virginia, before joining the National Union. She said her rural upbringing, both her parents drove school buses in Memphis, Virginia, spurs her drive to improve equity and support for rural students. "We are not only educators, not only organizers. We are advocates. We are the ones to know what our students need, and we are willing to fight for all of them," Moss said. "The nation's largest teachers union," she said, "can be and must be the most powerful force in America, and Princess Moss will need to steer the union as it confronts big challenges. It faces a hostile administration in the White House, the rollout of a federal school choice program that the union contends could cut into school funding, as well as membership and a teacher workforce whose demographics are rapidly changing." Moss, currently the union's vice president, won the election at this year's Representative Assembly with 50.3% of the vote of some 5,800 delegates, barely avoiding a runoff with Kate Diaz, the president of the 40,000-member Connecticut Education Association. The relatively close contest is unusual in an organization where incumbents typically move up a slot in each electoral cycle. This year's race also included Sean Spiller of the 200,000-member New Jersey Union and Tanya Kapner, an English and history virtual education teacher in the Oakland, California district. "We have been on the defense for too long. We have been defending funding, defending rights, defending the very existence of public education," Moss said in a speech to delegates on July 4th. "We must go on the offense." This is Kristen Parker for Working Voices on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
That was Kristen Parker with this morning's Education Workers Report Card. And finally, from the KPFK News Desk, Associate Producer Hal Lohr brings us this morning's Working Voices Update.
The representative from California has the floor.
Sing out to the president, gas man. Bust away is your punishment.
Thank you, Marissa. First up in this Working Voices update, in the latest national job numbers, hiring slowed sharply in June, even as the unemployment rate fell, curbing some of the momentum in job growth this year. Non-farm payrolls increased 57,000 last month, after downward revisions to the prior 2 months took some of the shine off recent blockbuster reports from Bureau of Labor Statistics data Thursday showed. And the unemployment rate fell to 4.2%, even as labor force participation plunged. The payroll figures, which were lower than all but one estimate in a Bloomberg survey, suggest the labor market still faces challenges despite signs of strength in recent months. The pullback in hiring was led by the biggest decline in leisure and hospitality payrolls since 2020, reflecting weaker-than-usual seasonal hiring, according to the BLS. Ahead of the report, some economists were expecting the FIFA World Cup to boost payrolls in the sector. S&P 500 futures remained higher, while the two-year Treasury yields fell and investors also scaled back bets on a Federal Reserve interest rate increase this year. The jobs report comprises two surveys, one of households and the other of employers. The survey of households, which is used to calculate the unemployment and participation rates, was more downbeat, though it can be more volatile. The participation rate, the share of population that is working or looking for work, dropped to 61.5%, the lowest level in more than 5 years, according to last Thursday's report. But the BLS said when accounting for population adjustments, it was little changed from a year earlier, even if participation for so-called prime-age workers between the ages of 25 and 54 dropped to 83.3%, matching the lowest level since 2023. The healthcare and social assistance sector, which has been a primary driver of job growth in recent years, continued to lead hiring, accounting for most of the increases in June. Manufacturing and construction payrolls also rose, and many economists have pointed to the data build-out as a possible driver of demand for construction labor in 2026, even as home building continues to be restrained by elevated interest rates. At the same time, some big tech companies, such as Meta Platforms Incorporated and Microsoft Corporation, are reducing headcounts in part to offset spending on artificial intelligence. Information payrolls continue to decline, marking the 17th drop of the last 18 months. Employment in the financial activities sector, another key employer of white-collar workers, seen as among the most vulnerable to automation, was little changed. Average hourly earning rose 3.5% from a year earlier. Economists are paying close attention to how labor supply and demand dynamics are impacting pay, especially as inflation begins to outpace wage growth in many sectors. Consumer sentiment is recovering somewhat now that U.S.-Iran peace negotiations have supposedly resumed and oil prices have tumbled, which may encourage employers to ramp up hiring in the months to come, but separate data out Thursday showed applications for unemployment benefits were little changed last week. Layoffs have remained low in recent years, contributing to what economists have described as a low fire, low hire labor market.
Don't be left out, don't fall behind. Build your own and you'll be free. We can scale, we can grow. We the creators we've always loved. It's the next evolution, can't you see? AI's not the enemy. It's the key.
And yep, I can just see the hate mail now. But hey, journalism. Because that was an excerpt from the song Take the Lead by AI-generated, quote, actor, end quote, Tilly Norwood. And in SAG-AFTRA news, that very controversial actor, Tilly Norwood, is now set to star in its first feature film titled Misaligned. For those who did not know, Tilly Norwood is an entirely virtual creation owned by Jacoia, a talent studio attached to the AI production company Particle 6. Billed as the first fully AI-created actor, the creation of Norwood has sparked a Hollywood backlash after it was rumored last year that Particle 6 was seeking professional agent representation for their AI character. And now, Particle 6 says they are developing a feature film which will act as a vehicle for Norwood. According to a press release, Misaligned will be a comedy drama with the AI nature of Norwood at the center of the plot. In a recent press statement, Particle 6 CEO Eileen van der Velden said the film will absolutely be funny, chaotic, and self-aware, and now with our first feature film, we will not only be showcasing the very latest AI tools and their applications, but we'll also be helping traditional filmmakers who join the crew to upskill and transition to a world where AI will play an increasingly important part. Particle 6 also says they plan to hire traditional film and TV professionals, such as directors, writers, and editors, to work alongside AI specialists to develop the film. Back in March, Particle 6 released their music video starring Norwood for the AI-generated song Take the Lead as a demo of capabilities, which did receive a great deal of negative feedback online and was dismissed by industry critics as an abysmal slop. SAG-AFTRA had already issued a statement condemning Tilly Norwood as a contentious subject in Hollywood, where the Acting Guild has stated that categorically Tilly Norwood is not an actor, and that its character generated by a computer program that was trained on the work of countless professional performers without permission or compensation, declaring in Variety back in September that AI doesn't solve any problems. It creates the problem of using stolen performances to put actors out of work, jeopardizing performer livelihoods, and devaluing human artistry. The Guild added that signatory producers should also be aware that they may not use synthetic performers without complying with traditional contractual obligations, which require notice and bargaining whenever a synthetic performer is going to be used. To that, Particle 6 creator Eileen van der Velden issued a defense saying Tilly was not a replacement for a human being, but a creative work, a new tool just as animation, puppetry, or CGI opened fresh possibilities without taking away from live acting. But for now, as an AI character-driven movie goes into production, where the lines will be drawn and the legal battles will be fought between AI companies and human SAG-AFTRA performers remains to be seen. More on this story as it develops, or perhaps is generated.
And that's our show for this week. Once again, we're asking our labor partners, locals, and regional officers to seriously consider underwriting this show, because Working Voices and KPFK could really use your support. So please contact the station at 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org to explore the possibilities. We need to hear from you. You can also email your comments or questions to workingvoices@aol.com. Please contribute if you can at 818-985-5735. This is Joe Ayala, president of Navy CWA Local 53.
And I'm your co-host, Marissa Remsky of CWA Local 9003.
Our thanks to Dan McCrory, Steve Zeltzer, Gary Scott, Reggie Wong, Kristen Parker, Hal Lohr, and of course our guests. Please continue to give what you can and keep us going. We're in this together. And of course, always remember to educate, agitate, and organize. Have a great week, everybody.
Got so much work, yeah, yeah.
Hello, I'm Ian Masters, the host of Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org and heard on KPFK Mondays through Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. Background Briefing looks into three or four of the important stories and issues of the day to provide an in-depth daily briefing with context, history, and insight from the best-informed guests closest to the scene, who offer analysis and details often overlooked by the soundbite-driven media more and more controlled by Trump-friendly oligarchs. So if you want facts and information to inform a motivated majority to save our democracy before it's stolen next November, tune in Mondays to Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. for your background briefing here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and worldwide at kpfk.org.
Thinking about donating your unwanted car, truck, or boat? Why not donate it to KPFK? It's a tax deductible, and it helps keep all your favorite programs on air. Call our representatives by dialing 1-877-KPFK-AUTO, 1-877-KPFK-8255.